Welcome to the Big Three Podcast. This podcast answers three big questions raised from Sunday's sermon by the congregation of Guymere Baptist. The Big Three Pod seeks to discuss these questions, explore issues, unpack theology, provide further information and explanation to help your faith grow. You can listen to the original sermon on your favourite podcast platform or at guymerebaptist.org.au. Our prayer is that this pod helps you as you follow Jesus.
Well, welcome to the Big Three. My name is Mark. I'm the senior pastor here at Guymere Baptist Church and your host for the next half hour or so as we do unpack three big questions from last week's message. As a community of faith, we've been working our way backwards through Romans on the premise that the more clearly we understand the pastoral context to which Paul is writing, the more easily we'll be able to navigate the theologically and doctrinally rich opening chapters. And so in this first term, we've been looking at chapters 12 through 16, the final section of Romans, and have been, in fact, working our way more or less backwards through that from chapter 16 through to chapter 12. But on Sunday, I looked at one passage that I had skipped over, and that is in chapter 13, verses 8 to 14, where Paul kind of reprises the theme of love that he has put to one side as he's talked about submission to authorities and paying taxes. And then his interest in reminding them of the urgency of the moment in light of what has happened in Christ. And those two themes, those two motivators of love and the, you know, the second coming of Jesus, shall we say, or the coming of the age to come, are the motivation that he gives just before he gets into the most significant issue that he seems to be addressing, the most pressing pastoral concern, and that is their inability, it seems, to be able to eat lunch together, right? Where the Jewish believers are offended by what the Gentiles are eating, and the Gentiles are holding the Jews kind of in contempt for not being able to experience the freedom of Christ, and off it goes. And so I think there's something quite significant for this, for these two themes, these two motivators, to kind of frame up for us almost the whole section. And so the questions reflect some of those themes. So the questions that we're going to be looking at today are these. How do we live urgently in the light of the long delay of Jesus's return? Which is a good question that I think we do grapple with. It's hard to feel urgency when something has been delayed, well, for 2,000 years. So that's a great question to start with. Secondly, how do we navigate conversations and discourse with Christians of different denominations, e.g., a relative saying they would never step foot in a Baptist church? And I will say, when I read that question, the first part of the question seemed fairly straightforward until the example was given of someone saying they would never step foot in a Baptist church. And that kind of, I think, ramps it up a little bit. So we'll unpack that in a couple of stages. And then the third question is, if Paul was writing this letter to Guymere Baptist Church, what problems would he be asking us to fix? And that's a tricky one for lots of reasons. One, I'm the pastor, and so, you know, there's no end of things that I would love us to address as a community of faith, but I'm not convinced that they're necessarily what Paul would get at. But I'll have a bit of a crack at framing that up for us as well. It's a great question for us as we come to the end of this first section of our Romans series. So let's get stuck in. The first question picks up the idea of living urgently. Paul uses the metaphor of it nearly being dawn, that, you know, the night has is nearly over, the morning is nearly here, it's time to wake up from your slumber. And urges them to demonstrate their understanding of the times, right? So if things are urgent, then there ought to be a reflective urgency in your actions, right? You can tell someone who's working on a deadline, right? They're staying up late, they're bringing work home, they're a little snappish because they're not eating as well as they could or sleeping as well as they ought, right? There's something about their activity, their behavior, that reflects their sense of urgency. And for the earliest Christians, they lived with, it seems, this very, very present sense that Jesus would return, like, really, really imminently, which is understandable. The accounts of Jesus's post-resurrection appearances, you know, when he ascends to heaven at the end of Matthew, or end of Luke, rather, and the angels basically say, you know, you will see him coming in the clouds again, like, as he's left, you'll see him come, which suggests that it's happening now, right? Like, within a generation. There are a number of other passages that kind of hint at this real imminence. Scholars actually suggest that you can see in some of the epistles, the later epistles, kind of a grappling with the delayed return of Christ. You see that in things like the establishment of structures and order in the church that were not necessarily thought about early in the piece because, well, Jesus is coming back any minute, so there's no sense in kind of, you know, systematizing anything. There's no sense in creating a process or a structure or thinking this through. And then as the New Testament develops, there are similar developments of order and structure and whatnot as things kind of settle and they have to wait. So the question then becomes for us, you know, the better part of 2,000 years on, how do we maintain that sense of urgency? And I actually think one of the ways to do that is not to focus on the return of Jesus, which might sound a little counterintuitive now that I say it out loud. But I think part of the problem that we have in terms of feeling that sense of urgency is if people say, you know, hey, Jesus, you know, Jesus is coming. You're like, well, yeah, he is. And it could be any minute. Like, it really could be. Like, it could happen before the end of this podcast, I suppose. But, you know, chances are, given where we're up to, it's not going to happen right now. And so it's hard to generate an internal sense of urgency with an event that is really uncertain, right? The whole thing for us is that urgency comes through a deadline, right? That's the issue for us, right? And so when there's no firm deadline, it's difficult for us to maintain a sense of urgency. And I think a sense of urgency then needs to be tied to not the event of Jesus's return necessarily, although we ought to try, I think, to kind of maintain our hope in that reality, right? We shouldn't just kind of set that to one side. But I think it kind of, our urgency ought to fall or stem from the task that we have been given, the work that we have been given. You know, Jesus tells a number of parables that seem to reflect the kind of the end, right? You know, about a king leaving his servants behind and just telling them to, you know, do the stuff and going off for an indeterminate period of time. And that the servants who are rewarded are the ones who were faithful to just do the work that had been left to them. You know, whether it be the bags of gold, you know, where they invested it and created more, or whether it's just simply those who were doing the right work and doing it well as if the master were there, like acting like the master was still there. And I think that's a way for us to maintain a sense of urgency, to be aware of and reflecting upon the task that Jesus has left us. So it becomes less about when will Jesus return and more about really wanting, when he returns, to be able to demonstrate that we've been a good and faithful servant, right? So that helps, I think, create a little bit of a sense of urgency that stems from the purpose of what we're on about. I also think that, you know, one of the illustrations I used on Sunday about the already but not yet, that when Paul at the start of chapter 12 said, do not be conformed to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. He is talking about the end of one age and the start of another, right? There's this overlap. This age continues and the age to come is yet to fully arrive, but it has begun to arrive in Jesus. And I use the illustration of giving notice at work. You know, you've decided that you're going to take another job, and so you give your 2 weeks notice or your 6 week notice or whatever notice you need to give, and from that point on, the clock is ticking on the end of the current job, the end of the current age, and the start of the new one. And, you know, if you've already accepted a new job, like that is becoming more and more relevant to you, and the current job becomes less and less relevant. And I think there's something quite valuable in considering, you know, that when we put our faith in Jesus, we have essentially accepted a new position at a different company, and we have put in our notice to this one. And I think one of the ways that we can reflect our urgency is by making sure that we are no longer being conformed by the pattern of this age, that we are recognizing that we are made for something else, that we are destined for something else, that our future is what Jesus has in mind for us, that our future is the kingdom, and that we ought to be living and preparing for that rather than kind of continuing to do the old work. And I reckon that there's something in that space, you know, about how we think about our current age, about its promises, which are usually false, or at least only partially true, about its values and about its assumptions, about its priorities, and trying to become less relevant, allowing it to become less relevant in our lives, becoming a little bit more detached, not in some sort of stoic detachment kind of way, but just to be a little bit more detached from the things of this world, because this is not our future. This world is not our future. Our future lies someplace else. So I think there's a handful of those sorts of things that we can be doing that will, if not foster a sense of urgency, I think will at least encourage actions that demonstrate that we understand the times, that this age is passing away, that the new age is coming, and that we are seeking to live and behave in ways that are fit for where we're going rather than, you know, where we currently are. So I think those are some ways in which we can do that. I think it's valuable, you know, we don't talk a lot about, you know, the return of Christ, and that's in part because of some of the big debates about it and how you read some of the apocalyptic texts and all of those sorts of things. And it very quickly, regardless of how careful we are, descends into, you know, trying to determine when it's all going to wrap up. And I don't think that really helps us in the end. Pardon the pun. So I think there is something valuable, though, about keeping in mind the fact that, you know, Jesus has promised to return in the timing of the Father, and the Father has set a time, and that time is nearer now than it was when we first believed. And I think that that's a helpful wide angle perspective to keep in mind as we traverse our way through life, as we seek to follow Jesus as urgently as we can. I think one last thing to state, and that is that urgency is probably a tricky word, because it is difficult for us to maintain a sense of urgency for too long, right? You can end up burning yourself out, right, if you're too urgent for too long, right? And so the sense of urgency probably needs to be dialed down a little bit, right? We ought to live with an awareness and a demonstration that we understand the times, that we understand what's happened to us in Christ. That's probably the more important word than urgency. Because urgency is quite an intense emotion, right? When we're urgent, like, all of our senses are heightened, there's probably a lot of adrenaline running through us, and you cannot maintain that for very long without kind of falling in a heap. And I don't believe that we're meant to be kind of running hot in preparation for Jesus's return, but we are meant to be living appropriately, right? I think the idea is that, for those of you who have prepared for a half marathon or a full marathon or a triathlon or some sort of big deal, right? You end up, you spend all sorts of time. Now, I am speaking from secondhand knowledge. I've never done either of these things. You end up running every day or every other day. You run a little bit longer every single week, right? You're trying to make sure that you're ready to go, so that when you actually run the event, it will still be draining, it will still be difficult, but you are as prepared for it as possible. You can't imagine kind of doing no training and then being asked to run a half marathon tomorrow. Like, that's just not going to work. And so there's a sense that as Christians, we ought to be preparing ourselves so that when the age to come finally arrives, we ought to be pretty well prepared for it. You know, like we ought to be able to walk around in the new age when it's finally arrived and go, yeah, this kind of feels normal. Because I've been living this way. I've been preparing to live this way for a long time. And so the values of the kingdom that I have sought to develop in my life and the behaviors that I've sought to foster in my life, these have come to fruition and now I've arrived and it's actually not that different. Now, I think that heaven and the kingdom to come will be very different. But do you get the idea that we ought to be preparing in our day-to-day lives as followers of Jesus for the return of the Lord and for the coming of the kingdom and what that looks like for us? Second question is, how do we navigate conversations and discourse with Christians of different denominations? And that question, I think, can be answered in a particular way. And then there was an example given, which is a relative saying they would never step foot in a Baptist church. And that changed the nature of the conversation for me. Because I think my initial reaction was that there's lots of commonality between the different denominations. Many of the things that distinguish, that's probably a better way to talk about it, to distinguish or delineate between denominations are, I think, what Paul would call disputable matters. Matters of governance, right? Whether there are bishops or a council of elders or congregationally governed, right? Like, does it theologically, those are important. There's theological reasons for them, all that sort of stuff. But I don't know that you can argue for one or another comprehensively to the exclusion of the others. And so, you know, there's lots of disputable matters. And so I think, you know, when you sit down with people of other denominations, when you get a chance to do that, it's often really fascinating to talk about, you know, what they do and why they do it, things that they emphasize and things that they don't, and just kind of learn from each other a little bit. I think that, you know, so, you know, I remember years ago I did some teaching at Salvation Army training school. It was around preaching. And over lunch, I was talking with some of the officers. And even that was interesting, right? They're not pastors, they're officers. But talking to them about, you know, the things that they value most in an officer. And they said the things that they value most in a what we would call a senior pastor, I suppose, are the skills of administration and music. And I was really taken aback by that. You know, I think in our context, it's often leadership and preaching. Those would be two pretty highly valued and sought after skills. But for them, because they often have, you know, the Red Shield appeal and they have, you know, the Salvo stores and all those sorts of things. If you don't have administrative skills, it's really problematic. And music is just a really important part of their heritage. So it was just one of those really fascinating conversations where I learned something very, very different. And that's going to have implications then around, you know, how you discuss things and the values that you hold and all that kind of stuff. And I think there are places, there's some place for different denominations, if that makes sense. Because there are some denominations whose focus is very different, and I think it attracts a certain type of person whose spirituality really resonates. And so I think there's some space within it. This answer is already going kind of off the rails to some degree. In history, one of the most fascinating times was when the monastic movement started. So it started after Constantine, really. There were monks before that, but it really kind of took off after Constantine. Constantine was the Roman emperor. Christianity became first accepted in the empire, no longer illegal. Eventually, it became the official religion of the empire. And that just really changed the nature of the game, right? Christianity went from being this persecuted minority to suddenly being the kind of the it religion, right? Everyone wanted to be part of it. And the monks, it seems, had kind of rejected the softness and rejected the compromise that they sensed in it, and had kind of gone off to the desert. And, you know, they thundered from their pillars and from their caves about, you know, the decadence of the Christian movement and whatnot. And one of the most fascinating things in history, I think, is that the Roman Catholic Church, or the Church of the day, wasn't the Roman Catholic Church at that time, really, but they embraced the monastic movement. They kept the monastic movement within the folds of the church. And so suddenly there was this place for people who were a little bit more radical, who wanted to more literally follow Jesus, who really felt the call to that kind of ascetic lifestyle, for them to do that without breaking away from the church or leaving the church. I think that that, to some degree, is a wonderful model for different denominations. So I think the first part of the question, right, how do you navigate conversations and discourse? I would navigate them with curiosity, right? I'd ask a lot of questions. I would try not to judge. You know, one of my first responses when, you know, the salvos said, you know, administration music was kind of like, what? And I don't think it came across as judgy, but we have to be very careful about our reactions to those sorts of things. But finding out, like, that's a wonderful way to do it. The second part of the question, though, is, you know, for example, a relative saying they would never step foot in a Baptist church. And that kind of changes the nature, I think, of my answer a little bit. Because it suggests, of course, an antagonism between denominations, right? Where it's not just, you're part of the Lutheran Church, tell me a bit about that, or you're part of the Open Brethren Church, tell me a little bit about that, or you're from the Churches of Christ, you know, like where you can be curious because you're not kind of hating on each other. But it's very different when, you know, for instance, as it suggests, you have a relative who's like, I would never step foot in a Baptist church. I still think the principle of curiosity applies. I suspect that the rationale for some of that is probably based on, you know, past hurt, for instance. You know, I went to a Baptist church and there was, you know, misuse of power, or, you know, lousy people who, you know, hurt me, or whatever it was. Sometimes I think it's based on stereotypes, you know, like you kind of get a picture in your head of what those people are like, and you just think, God, I wouldn't like that very much. And that can be reinforced through, you know, through poor teaching that kind of attacks other denominations. I've never heard any of that, but I'm assuming it happens, right? Where, you know, if our denomination is right, then you can suddenly cast other denominations as wrong. And that shapes people's discipleships, as people's discipleship and the way they think about other denominations. So I think that you'd want to be curious about, you know, can you tell me why you would never step foot in a Baptist church, and find out what's going on. And I think that there's then opportunity then. Yeah, I don't think you want to try to convince somebody that, no, you should step into a Baptist church. You know, like, that's not the win. But I think that there's that sense, you know, a couple of weeks ago talked about, you know, don't be a Christian, be the Christian. I think in this context, you know, don't be a Baptist, be the Baptist. You know, like, to some degree, you'd like to think that you could say to a relative, like, do you trust me? Would you come to my Baptist church? Right? You know, because you trust me, and, like, you know that I'm not a lunatic, and you know that I'm not a crazy, and, you know, like, so would you come to my Baptist church, you know, for a baptism or a dedication or a, you know, whatever the case is. So I think that there's a number of ways that you can navigate that, but I think the primary interest is some curiosity, to find out why people oppose something, to find out why they dislike something, to unpack the things that they may have heard, or the things that they believed, or that they thought. And then I think, you know, to come back to the thought that there may be some space for different denominations within the body of Christ, right? Some different focuses. I think that there's great power in kind of giving permission to, you know, to say, I understand, you know, I understand that, you know, the focus, on this rather than that, doesn't kind of suit your spirituality. I think that there's some space in that. I think the other thing that you could do, you know, really, really pragmatically, if you were hoping to kind of get there is attend their church, you know, go with them to their denomination and spend a little bit of time there and demonstrate your willingness to be part of another part of the Christian church. But I think, you know, curiosity is a big piece in anything, but particularly when we're trying to navigate conversations between different denominations. And we may find that there are some differences that we simply cannot overcome. There are many disputable matters. I think there are some things that are less disputable, and how we navigate those are a little bit more complicated. Precisely what makes a disputable matter, we talked about this a few weeks ago. I do think one of the things that makes a disputable matter is if it's an area that is disputed, right? Like to some degree that becomes a disputed issue. And so just about any area of dispute can become an area of division. And we have to try to navigate whether those things that we have a dispute about are worth dividing over or not. And that's probably a question for another day. Finally, if Paul was writing this letter to Gaimia Baptist Church, what problems would he be asking us to fix? That's a really, it's a great question, but it's a really difficult question. I think I'm aware, you know, I don't want to overstep my mark as the pastor here to say, well, you know, it's obviously these things. So I don't want to overstep my authority in the first place. But secondly, I have a sneaky suspicion that there are things that Paul would want to address. And let's just assume for the moment that he would want to address them because they were the things revealed to him by the Spirit, right? So they weren't just things that he didn't like, but, you know, things that Jesus wanted to fix. I believe that there are probably some areas that would sit in my blind spot and our blind spot a little bit. And I don't know that I can think of any kind of issues, right, you know, that are kind of really... that are really clear for me. I think some of the characteristics, like when I think about the Roman church, I think that there would have been a certain amount of justification for their behaviors, right? Again, we don't really know how the divisions played themselves out. But in the long list of greetings, there are at least five house churches by the looks of it. And you can imagine that there would have been house churches that were far more Jewish and far more Gentile. And I can imagine, you know, to come back to the denominational question about them kind of saying, this is good, this is helpful, right? It's good for the Jewish Christians to spend time together. They kind of get each other. And, you know, we can spend time with the Gentiles too, but we're like, this is good for us. And there would have been a bunch of justifications around why we have allowed some divisions to exist. So I think that's an interesting indicator then for areas that we would need to address, areas where we have excuses for ongoing division. I think that would be an interesting one. The other thing that popped into my head was, I wonder if Paul would address Gaimia Baptist Church or whether he would address the churches of the Shire. Right. To some degree, you know, like we're not a huge church, but the reckonings of some scholars is that the Roman church that Paul is writing to with its five house churches and maybe more may not have been much bigger than 200 people combined. So we're not talking about a mega church here. And so to some degree, you know, Gaimia Baptist Church, we would have more than 200 people who kick about the place. But the idea of having diverse groups that meet in very diverse parts of the city, I think I do wonder whether it would be a letter to the Shire, the Christians of the Shire, or maybe of Sydney as a whole. And in which case, I think there may be some other issues that might be addressed. I suspect that's probably far too strong a term to use in this context. I do wonder, talking about curiosity, I do wonder if Paul would address the political context today. I think that one of the places that we see division in the evangelical church is in relationship to political positions. You see this played out quite strongly in the United States, you know, where evangelical Christians are almost exclusively, it seems, Republican voters, and often, you know, MAGA Republican, whereas Democratic, you know, or more progressive Christians are almost exclusively, it seems, this is how it's portrayed, Democratic voters. And I'm sure that there's an overlap between those things. It's not as stark, I think, even as it's presented in the media for us. But I do think that we see some of that the ripple effect of that, in terms of, you know, having political positions on things like immigration or on taxes or on the government's role in private life, about, you know, social services and those sorts of things, and tying those things to our faith in a particularly significant way. So I do wonder if Paul would have a thing or two to say about, you know, a reframing of chapter 13, right? About how we submit to the local authorities or pay taxes or how we vote. You know, that seems to me to be a fruitful place for Paul to reflect on. I suppose, you know, when it comes right down to it, perhaps a better way for me to frame this up is really to say, if Paul was writing this letter to Gamia Baptist Church, what problems would I want him to speak into, rather than, you know, trying to figure out what he would want to fix. What are the areas that I'd want him to speak into? And I think, you know, that list becomes longer. I think the political context here, I think, becomes a fairly important one. I'd be very interested to hear Paul's reflections on human sexuality in our current context and how he would frame that up, for instance. I think some of the political issues that are raised, you know, around, you know, things like immigration, for instance, I'd be interested to hear what Paul would have to say about that. I think, you know, some of the social ills that we have, you know, how he would respond to, you know, gambling, you know, like it's not included in any of the vice lists in the New Testament, but I think it would be included in one of ours. I think I'd be interested to hear Paul's reflections on capitalism. And what he thinks about our consumer mentality and what he would say about that, or about our desire to, you know, not just to consume things, but, you know, to travel. You know, what would he say about that? What would he say about retirement, you know, as a whole? What would he say about social media? Like, I think that list becomes really, really long, and, you know, that becomes a let's sit down with Paul and get him to do the big three, which would be a very exciting big three, I have to say. So I guess in answer to the question, I don't really know what Paul would say. I do know that there's a handful of areas that I'd be very interested to hear his opinion. But I do think the political one may be one of them that sits at the top. I think that's a resonance with what he already says in chapter 13. And I do think it has some implications for division in our community of faith as well. Even in Gamia Baptist Church, I think we hold very different political positions, and we kind of hold those things in tension a little bit. But I don't speak about them much in order to kind of facilitate that tension, right? To hold the tension, which can be its own kind of tension too. Great questions. Thank you for those of you who offered them. This coming Sunday, we really launch into our Easter services. So we'll be looking at the events of Palm Sunday and then obviously the death and resurrection of Christ the week after that. And we're going to be continuing the Easter theme into term two, looking at Eastertide. We're not going to be looking at a particular book of the Bible. Instead, we're going to be using the lectionary, the set of readings that many churches use, one from the Gospels, one from the Epistles, and then two from the Old Testament, usually one from the Psalms and another section of Scripture. And we'll be preaching on one or more of those each Sunday as we reflect on the resurrection life. But thanks for joining me, and hope that you can join me again next week. Until then, God bless.
Thanks for joining us at the GBC Big Three podcast. We trust you found this inspiring, encouraging, challenging, but ultimately helpful to enable you to follow Jesus. If you enjoyed this podcast, you can also listen to the We Are the Church podcast, a discussion pod with real stories from real people at Gamia Baptist as they share their experiences of faith and discipleship in action. If you've enjoyed this pod, why don't you rate and review it? This way others can discover the podcast too.